Good morning, everybody. We are nearing the end of our year in the Bible, Eating Well. We're down to the last three sections of the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. And we have some exciting things in store. This is a phenomenal book that's unlike any other book in the New Testament. There were other books of apocalyptic writing that were taking place around the same time the book of Revelation was written. So people of that day would be more familiar with it. You and I are not so familiar with the style of the book of Revelation. As I was reading the chapters 12 and 13 this week, part of the three chapters we were reading, I was reminded of that scene in The Wizard of Oz where Dorothy and her companions are approaching the dangers ahead, and they're warned of what they might be waiting for them. Do you remember the line? Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. And they're getting themselves worked up into a lather of anticipation of, we're going to have to deal with lions and tigers and bears. Well, chapters 12 and 13 just trumps that even further today. And so the title to today's message is A Dragon, Two Monsters, A Mother, A Child, and Angelic Battles, oh my. There's a lot to absorb in our 21st century minds as we look at what is I'm describing and others describe. This is the cosmic drama going on here in two acts in chapters 12 and 13. And so hang on as we explore some very vivid images and descriptions that are very symbolic, obviously. A number of years back, my wife and I led a team of, I think about 20 of us from the Evanston Vineyard, and we were in Kenya in East Africa visiting the newly forming vineyard church movement there. And we had an amazing time connecting with our brothers and sisters in Kenya. And at the end of our time, they drove us down to the southern part of the country near Tanzania, and we went to the great area of the wildlife reserve near where the Maasai tribesmen live. And as we were approaching the reserve, even before we got into it, we noticed that there was a zebra mother giving birth. And this is a baby zebra here. When they're first born, they don't have, all their stripes aren't the same color. You can see some of them are a little browner than others. And this is a baby zebra here that's a little bit older. I don't have the photograph. I decided not to show you the picture of the birth, you know, scene there. But we were watching it with great sense of anticipation and drama because our guides told us that this baby zebra who just dropped out on the ground has less than a half an hour to figure out how to get up and stand and move away quickly before the predators come in. 30-minute window at most, or they're dead. Because right nearby, both of these, I must say, are my own photographs. This, one of the great African lions there, these we found in abundance around there. And they can smell the smell of birthing going on, you know. And they're ready to jump in. And I have observed, and again, I'm not going to provide you pictures. You can go on to watch National Geographic television or something. But a lion kill is a very vivid experience that you don't forget. And we did see lion kill and cheetah kills and all kinds of things like that while we were traveling through that part of the country. What it reminds me of is how vulnerable the birthing process is, and something that is being newly born is in a high state of vulnerability. And it was made so extremely vivid to me to watch this zebra and say, get up, get up, get up, stretch your feet, and then fall back down again, and it would struggle, and the mom would cry, no, and it, literally, there's nothing anybody else could do to get that baby zebra up and moving, and then into the rest of the herd for protection before the predators came. That is a picture that is described in another way in chapter 12, we'll look at in a minute, of the book of Revelation, about the vulnerability in the spiritual realm of when new things are being born spiritually. That's a time of vulnerability as well, when the enemies and the predators, spiritually speaking, are ready to pounce before things are strong and developed. Birthing anything new is risky. Of course, new human babies are vulnerable. Some parts of the world, they do not name babies right away. There's a period of delay because the newborn fatalities are so high that they wait a while. In the Korean community, there's not as big a celebration at the birth of a child and as it is 1 year later on the first birthday. The child has survived the first year. Now we celebrate. That comes, I believe, out of a culture where you have a significant expectation that children may not make it through that first year. And so there's a delayed celebration because of the vulnerability of all the things that can assault a human child in that first year. If you're starting a new business, especially if you're trying to start a new restaurant, do you know what the mortality rate is for new restaurants in the first year? It's very high. How about that first year of marriage? The statistics in the first year and in the first 5 years of marriage indicate those are the most critical years where marriages are much more at risk at the beginning as two lives are coming together and figuring out, what did we get into? And how am I going to live with you and vice versa? New marriages are vulnerable, yes? It's risky, challenging. Well, we're going to see, as I said, the same thing is true in the spiritual realm. The book of Revelation was written in the 10th decade of the first century, some 60 to 70 years after the death of Jesus. It's one of the last books of the Bible that was written. And it was written, as I said, in a time where there were other kinds of apocalyptic writing that was being written that was full of all this wild and fantastic imagery. I mentioned this 2 years ago when we looked at the book of Revelation for a few weeks in the first three chapters. That was shocking to me to find out that in the first century, if you were going to have people give a top 10 list in the churches around the Mediterranean there of what was the most common or most popular book, most frequently book read in church, you'd be surprised to find out it was the book of Revelation. It was the first book that was widely read and the first one that was agreed upon to be accepted into the canon or the New Testament books. It was that well and importantly received and frequently read. And I asked myself, how can that be? Because it is like the least frequently read book of most of the books in the modern world. Why is it that this book captured the imagination and the interest of the early church in a way that they read it frequently and talked about it? It was circulated initially among the seven churches that are mentioned in chapters 1-3, where there's a message to each of these seven churches in Asia. But it spread to other churches as well. And the way it's been described is that when this book was first read, could be in a house church or a small group, and people are reading this, the description of John, that people were... They were seated, but they were seated on the edge of their seats, and they would read a couple chapters this week, and you got to come back next week to see what happens next. And it was like a major excitement because they were taking it in, and they were finding ways that this applied directly to their lives. Because one of the major themes, something that's mentioned to all the first seven churches in chapter 1-3, is. To the one who overcomes, this will be a reward. So what was the issue? They were dealing with some major things to have to overcome, particularly persecution and opposition. They wanted to know, how are we going to be able to survive and stand? Like, how are we going to survive like that baby zebra past the early days here? And so the question is, we really believe that overcoming is a key issue, and we need this. The central theme of this book is that there is a struggle going on between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan. And the people in the early church felt that in a visceral way in their daily lives, as they were a religious minority that was increasingly becoming under opposition. Let me summarize. The New Testament scholar N.T. Wright, talking about this book, says, "This book, in fact, offers one of the clearest and sharpest visions of God's ultimate purpose for the whole creation and of the way in which the powerful forces of evil at work in a thousand ways, but not the least in idolatrous and tyrannous political systems, it can be and are being overthrown through the victory of Jesus the Messiah and the consequent costly victory of his followers. It was a message that there is hope for victory when you are dealing with the opposition of the greatest military and political system that may have existed in the world up to that point in time. And that system is being turned against you, the followers of Jesus. And this book brings a message of hope that the victory of Jesus is greater over the world systems and their tyrannies. Now, if you're dealing with that every day, that's a book you want to read. And maybe there's some ways that this applies, this, that why we would be interested in reading this today. But there are some obstacles that we've mentioned. The people who read the book of Revelation in the first century really knew their Bibles. And you have to know the Bible well to understand the book of Revelation, because there are many references there to other books, to the Exodus, to the prophecies of Ezekiel and Daniel. And those are not today as widely read and understood as they were in the first century. These people had to be very good students of the literature of the Old Testament and these prophecies. In addition, there's a lot of historical and cultural information about the first century that many of us do not have, and so that makes it difficult to understand what the situation was of the people who received this first book. And perhaps this is maybe an issue for some of us as too. We may be tempted to view our world from the perspective and the distortions of the fact that we live in the richest and most powerful nation that has ever existed. We are living in the land of the last remaining superpower. We're just a flick of an economic wrist, and a decision in Washington, D.C. can cause a foreign economy to crumble and thousands of people to be put in desperate places. Or a quick decision in the war rooms of power to release cruise missiles can bring devastation upon armies and cities and thousands of people. Now that is intended to be used wisely and for good. But being the only superpower in the world, somehow we don't always manage to use everything wisely and for good. Are you right? Are you with me there? Sometimes our power and our wealth is used selfishly and foolishly and even with evil purposes. We are not as pure as we think. And when we read the Bible from the perspective of living in a country like this, it makes us even more difficult for us to understand the plight of the people to whom the book of Revelation was given. Are you with me? We are challenged by the environment that we live in, understanding the environment that they lived in. Because this book was written from the perspective of the oppressed, from the persecuted outsiders who did not have the privileges of wealth and power. They were the ones who read this book and understand it much more easily than we did. So let's take a quick survey of this two-chapter drama. Every drama, you go to the theater, they're going to give you a book, and then the first page is going to tell you who the players are, so you can figure that out. There are some amazing players in these two chapters. There's a dragon, two monsters, a woman and a child. There's angels, and then there's others that are literally referred to as our Christian brothers and sisters. And it says these are signs. The dragon, the monsters, the woman, they are not literal people. They are signs or symbolic of spiritual things. The dragon, the woman, the monsters, they're not literal. There's something more. When you read about this monster or this person has several heads and they have crowns on them, well, you probably can understand that the crowns indicate authority. And they say, well, in addition to, you can't take this literally. You may have several heads and the number of heads doesn't count. The crowns tell you something. Then they have several horns. Well, how many horns and what way the horns are twisted or whatever doesn't count. But what horns are signs of strength. So you have a symbol of somebody who has authority and strength. And don't get caught up in all the details of the colors and all of the stuff that today we would create with a computer-generated graphics, you know. The dragon in the story, it dealt with this literally, represents Satan. It says the woman, she represents kind of an idealization of God's people, both in Israel and the people of God, the church. And this vivid drama was written because the people in the church need to know then, and we need to know now, that our present struggles and sufferings are not a sign that somehow God has gone to sleep on the job. Are we in the midst of turmoil and confusion and suffering? They were being given all these wild signs to say, God's aware of all this. God's dealing with this. God has a plan. There is an ultimate objective that God's working at. He isn't just checked out here. They needed to hear that. Anybody here need to hear that? That's right. They are signs that there is a great cosmic drama that we are a part of just as they were, and that we get to play a vital part in this role. Chapter 12 describes heavenly warfare in these mythological terms. It explains to us, God's people on earth, then and now, why we must face satanic evil and persecution. Because it assures us that in reality, the one who opposes us, Satan, has already been conquered. And that we are therefore able to conquer him, as it says in this passage, by the blood of the Lamb. So let's jump into this chapter 12, the first act of this drama, which illustrates what I said at the beginning. Spiritual births provoke deadly opposition. If you're taking notes, hang on, there's all these wild signs. A spectacular sign appeared in the sky, writes John. And there was a woman who was dressed in the sun and who had the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars in her head, and she was pregnant. And she cried out from labor pains and the agony of giving birth. You're really getting our attention, John. Another sign then appeared in the sky. A huge, fiery, red serpent with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its heads. Again, the numbers don't matter, really. And the serpent stood in front of the woman. And other translations use the word dragon for the serpent. And she was going to give birth. And the serpent stood in front of her. Why? So that it could devour her child when it was born. And she gave birth to a son, a boy. And here we get real specific. Here, we're not talking just generally and symbolically. John gets very specific because he says, this boy is going to rule all the nations with an iron scepter. Now, this is why it's good to be a first century person who knows your Old Testament, because this is one of the most famous passages talking about Jesus, the Messiah, from chapter 2 of the book of Psalms. If you haven't read the book of Psalms, you're not going to figure this passage out. But if you know Psalms 2 is a prophetic messianic passage, John is saying the baby that's born is the one who's going to rule with an iron scepter. He says, and here's what happened. There was this birth that took place, and he's describing this spiritually phenomenal, wild scene. And then this serpent, the dragon's ready to devour the baby. And then her child was snatched away and taken to God and to his throne. In one sentence, he summarizes the whole life of Jesus. It doesn't give you all the details and all the way through the death and resurrection. He just goes right from the birth to the ascension in one phrase, because that's what's important for them to understand, that although Jesus is threatened and was attacked by the serpent, God protected him and raised him up to the throne where he can rule with an iron scepter. You who are beleaguered in these 7 cities in East in Asia, take hope. You who are feeling under it in the villages and towns and cities around Chicago, take hope, because he was raised up. He was snatched away and taken to God and his throne. The story continues. Then the woman fled into the wilderness. the woman representing the people of God here, where, and what happened there? God had prepared a place for her so that she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. We could spend a long time trying to figure out what that number means, but we're not going to. What we need to know is what happened to the woman. What happened to the woman who was the one who gave birth to and was connected with the Messiah coming? She was protected. If that's a reference to God's people, the people who read this the first time and heard it read aloud in the church are saying, he's got a way for us. He's got a protection for us. And then there's this. Then the angels jump in here. There was a war that broke out in heaven. Michael and the angels had to fight a war with the serpent and the angels fought, but it was not strong enough, the serpent, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven, and so this huge serpent was thrown down. The ancient snake named the devil, which is literally the slanderer, and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world, he was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with it. It doesn't take much interpretation to figure out that this is a message of victory and strength and hope for God's people. That the one who would attack us and slander us and accuse us has already been thrown down. Jesus even had a picture of this. When he sent the disciples out and they were doing kingdom things and driving out demons and healing of diseases, he says, I saw Satan being thrown down. He saw this same picture that John says here. And then if you don't have this underlined in your Bible or use your electronic highlighter on your device, this is the passage you want to really remember. Because when John says, I heard a loud voice in heaven, I won't use my loudest voice. I don't want to blow this place up here. But here's the message that we need to hear. Now, the salvation, power, kingdom of our God, and the authority of his Messiah have come. And the one who accuses our brothers and sisters, the one accusing them day and night in the presence of God, has been thrown out. And they won. Let me say that again. They won the victory over him because of the blood of the Lamb. Because Jesus had paid the price in his death. And by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their life so much that they refused to give it up. They were willing to go to any extent for Jesus. So he says, be glad for this reason. Heavens and those who live in them. And how horrible it is for the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to them with fierce anger. And now we've been experienced all the things in our world that come out of the fierce anger of the devil all these years, knowing that he has just little time left. Well, the story continues, and we quickly, it says that there's more that the serpent's up to. So when the serpent saw that it had been thrown down to earth, it persecuted the woman who had given birth to the boy. And the woman, and this reminds me of something out of Lord of the Rings. You know, so he's chasing the woman. And the woman was given two wings of the large eagle in order to fly away from the snake to her place in the wilderness. You know that scene in Lord of the Rings, they get to rescue the eagles, you know? Where do you think Tolkien got these ideas? Tolkien was a Jesus follower and had read all these stories. He was borrowing some of his imagery, I think, here. So she's taken to the wilderness where she could be taken care of for a time and a half. And the battle goes on. The snake's not giving up quickly with the woman put in a safe place in the wilderness. Where I try to picture this, the snake's mouth poured out a river of water behind the woman in order to sweep her away. This water is just chasing her, whatever, into the wilderness. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth, swallowing the river which had poured out of the serpent's mouth. It just goes on and on. You know, everything he throws at her, God deals with. The river is going to sweep her away, and all of a sudden the earth just opens up and swallows the river, goes right down inside it. God will provide a way for his people, is what John is telling us. The image is saying when you're being chased and when it looks like you're threatened on every side, God has a way. And all this mystical imagery is to encourage our hearts that God is providing a way. The serpent then wasn't too happy with the angry with the woman. So he went away to fight her other children. the ones who keep God's commands and hold on to the testimony of Jesus. The serpent stood on the sandy shore of the sea. Well, we can't begin to break all this apart, but we got the main point, don't we? The woman was protected. The serpent is frustrated, and yet he still goes after her children because the final chapter has not been concluded. But we know where it's going. God's authority, his salvation, power, and kingdom of our God, and the authority of our Messiah have come. Just going back to this notion for a moment about the very beginning parts of the spiritual birth. Spiritual birth are generally opposed. Over the last 40-some years, have we started new churches. We started dozens of new churches out of this church. And I have found that first year of the new church, it's very vulnerable. Somehow, all kinds of things can happen in that first year. And we put together prayer teams and do all kinds of spiritual warfare, trying to protect those churches in their infancy because they are vulnerable. Seems like every false teacher in the county wants to show up there and talk to them. It seems like everything that could oppose them on every level is there because why? Does the enemy of our souls want more new churches planted? Certainly not. And in those early days, the battles are strong. And in new outreach, if you're involved in a new ministry, if you've been asked to lead a small group this fall for the first time, I'm telling you, start praying now. Because the enemy doesn't want you to lead that new group. He doesn't want to see more lives transformed by God's power. And so new things in the spiritual realm get regularly opposed. If you want to, put that picture in your mind that John says there. There is a serpent waiting for that baby to come out to devour it. But God's purpose is to preserve it. But we need to be wise to these things. This warfare, spiritual warfare, is a real aspect of our lives. Yes? And we should not be naive and thinking casually, oh, I'll just do this and, you know, don't have to take it all that seriously. Don't need all this prayer. Oh, yes, we do. When new leaders are released, when a new spiritual movement is going, there are real dangers. When a move of God begins, he will send all kinds of things to interfere with it and distort it and lead it astray. The enemy, when you try to take new territories, when we've tried to move and plant a church in a new village or a new town or a new country, and we're working in several new countries right now, we know that that early time is a time of vulnerability, a time where you need extra warfare. I have learned the hard way that our enemy doesn't like us to purchase new property. He's the Lord of this earth, and I really believe this. He takes the real estate seriously. He likes to have as much of it under his control as possible. And I know every church virtually that I've been acquainted with, when they get around to getting property, all kinds of things come up to oppose them. I know from 10 years of battle and experience and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of legal bills what it took to get this property. That the opposition was not flesh and blood, really. The opposition was spiritual and took 10 years of spiritual warfare as well as a few dollars for that to happen. Just two quick other similar examples. Literally, the son that was born, that's prophesied, that's talked about in John, it's a reflection of something that literally happened. What happened when Jesus was born? Did the powers that be take notice? They sure did. The political powers, the governmental powers, the military powers of King Herod took notice, did he not? And here you have a baby, a harmless-looking infant probably. And what did Herod do? He commanded his soldiers to go to the land where they told the baby was in Bethlehem and take the sword to every child under the age of 2, I think, or age of 3, and to slaughter them. That's how seriously this actually happened. Jesus' life was immediately put at risk when he was born, right? When God wanted to deliver people out of Egypt, and he wanted to raise somebody up to do it, who did he pick in the Old Testament? Moses. Did Moses get an easy start? What happened to Moses? Pharaoh decided we have too many Jewish boys and girls around. And so he commanded, we're going to put to death all the boys under a certain age in Egypt. Are you seeing a pattern here? It's happened in the real world physically. It happened spiritually. So Pharaoh put out a decree to kill all the boys, all the Jewish boys, right? Except that God's plan always is victorious. And God's plan wasn't just to hide Moses somewhere. He says, you know where I'm going to hide him? I'm going to hide him in Pharaoh's house. What a sense of humor. Pharaoh, you think you're in charge here. I'm going to put that baby in the bulrushes in the Nile River. Guess who's going to find him? Your daughter. Who's going to adopt him? Your daughter. Who's going to make him a prince? Your daughter, Pharaoh, because our God has come to establish his kingdom and his power and his authority and his purposes. And the same is true of all the spiritual endeavors we're a part of. Take hope in what he did for Jesus and Moses and when you're starting something new. Are you with me? New churches are spiritually vulnerable. Anything new, a new group. You start a new small group, I always tell people, pray a lot and beware of spiritual saboteurs. Often they will show up at the first meeting. And you have to figure out, is this person here going to help this group or is this person sent here to destroy this group? I've seen people sent to destroy groups. So let us beware, take note of this. Isn't it amazing how this wild, crazy vision in chapter 12 actually makes sense for you and I in a practical way? Okay, let's jump ahead and do chapter 13. The second act of this drama. And John does not shy away from any controversy, let me tell you. He really goes after it. I would describe what he is saying in chapter 13, and I put it on the screen. Now, is that John warns that there is a lethal mixture to beware of putting together state power and religious devotion. Now, I have to walk carefully here in the day in which we live, but this is happening and has happened time and time again, and it is a lethal mixture when state power and religious devotion are put together. And he describes it as two monsters. And this is a lot to read. I'm going to read it quickly here of chapter 13, and then we'll get to the meaning before we finish here. So John says, now, man, what a night he had. I don't know if these dreams came the same night. I couldn't handle this many dreams like this in one night, you know. Woo. See, chapter 12, now chapter 13, part second act of the play, you come back after the intermission, and then it keeps going, you know. He saw a beast, or literally a monster, coming out of the sea. It had, again, 10 horns, 7 heads, 10 crowns on its horns, and there were insulting names towards God on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like, well, it was like a leopard, but its feet were like a bear, but its mouth was like a lion. You really can't put this together in your mind, except that all these things don't sound good. The serpent gave its power, kingdom, and far-reaching authority to this monster, this beast. And one of the beast's heads looked like it had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound was healed. There is a considerable stream of biblical interpretation that believes that this whole section is in reference, surely referencing the Roman Empire, but specifically the great persecutor of the church at that time, Nero, who there was a time that after they thought he was dead, there was rumors that he wasn't dead. And so a number of people think that this might be specifically referenced, this one head to Nero. But that's all I'm going to go there if you want. You can read all the commentaries if you want to read pages on that, but I'll just say that may be what's referencing. Now, here's what happens though when they see this great political power. All the people of the world were amazed and followed this monster, this beast. And notice the word, they worshiped Satan because of this beast, because it had given authority to the beast. And they also worshiped the beast and said, who is like the beast? Who can fight a war like with it? And the beast was allowed to speak arrogant and insulting things. It was given authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to insult God, to insult his name and his tent, a place where those who are living in heaven. It was allowed to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. It was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. Everyone living on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name is not written in the book of life. That book belongs to the Lamb who was slaughtered before the creation of the world. So if anyone has ears, let him listen. If anyone's taken prisoner, he must go to prison. If anyone's killed with a sword, he must be killed. In this situation, God's holy people need endurance and confidence. What a ride here. But he's saying that there are political powers and entities who draw worship to themselves, devotion, where you pledge your allegiance to them. And they want to have authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation, and they do for a while. But he says, God's people, you need endurance and confidence. These beasts, these monsters, ultimately will not win. They will take their toll. They will exact their price. They will put some to death, as they did. One reason, just the whole catalog of horrible stories about Nero, he would throw lavish parties out and at night, and instead of lighting torches, he would kill Christians, hang their bodies on the poles, soak them with some sort of an accelerant, and then light them on fire so that they would be the torchlights for the parties. Now, it gets worse than that, and I'm not going to go there, but that's bad enough to let you see the fear that would inspire in followers of Jesus, right? So that when they read this, they say, you know what? He's right. It's going to take some endurance and confidence to stand up against the mightiest ruler in the earth right then. This is what they were going through. That's why we need to know some of the historical context of these stories, like I said. Then now there's a second one. There's another monster or beast who came from the earth, and it had two horns like a lamb. Most believe that that is a kind of John's parody of saying that this is kind of a parody of Jesus. There's a religious dimension to the second beast or the second monster. And the religious dimension tries to direct people to follow the first beast or monster. It talked like a serpent. The second beast uses all of the authority of the first beast in its presence. The second beast makes the earth and those living in it worship the first beast. So the second beast is some way subservient and trying to get people to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. It goes on, the second beast performs all spectacular signs. It makes fire come down from heaven. It deceives those living on earth with the signs it's allowed to do. And it goes on, it tells the living on earth to make a statue to the beast. The second beast is allowed to put breath into the statue of the beast. It goes on describing all these things. It says, the second beast forces all people, important and unimportant people, rich and poor people, free people and slaves, to be branded on their right hands or on their foreheads. It does this so that no one may buy or sell unless he has the brand, which is the beast's name or the number of its name. In this situation, wisdom is needed. Yeah, for sure. Let the person who has insight figure out the number of the beast because it's a human number. The beast number is 666. Now, I could spend the next 5 weeks talking about what 666 might mean, but I'm not going to. I'm just say that this, many people believe this chapter 13 is actually the essence and center of this whole book of Revelation. That first monster or beast are the powers that be, the Roman Empire. It represents the deification of secular authority. One writer says, the Roman Empire was powerful in many senses. It exercised one particular power, which became a cause of great trials to the early Christians, and that was the growing practice of emperor worship. It meant that an increasing number of people were required publicly to make a fateful choice between Caesar and Christ. Every age has its equivalent test of a Christian's true allegiance. For them, it meant actual persecution and the threat of martyrdom. If you look on the Roman coins today, a number of the coins for a particular emperor will indicate that they are divine or want to be seen as divine. One wanted to be called the Son of God. And in the pictures, even on the coins, they're dressed in the clothing that would indicate some similar to some ancient pagan deity. So John has a very dark picture here of this evil. He sees this power as twisted. That a few decades earlier, Apostle Paul, Romans chapter 13, says, no, the state's given its authority, it's given the sword to execute justice and to promote righteousness. Well, 30 years later, under John's time, the time of Nero, the state is gone far off the track of justice. And John has a much darker view than the Apostle Paul did of the state. It was a system of violent oppression. It was founded on conquest. It maintained by violence and oppression. It was full of tyranny and economic exploitation. And the book of Revelation is written, some say, from the underside of history, from the perspective of the victims of Rome's power and glory. Those included, of course, the Christians. And then you, this second beast, which is promoting the worship of it. Let me just make one comment about this whole thing. About what is this mark they're talking about? Well, if you were commanded to offer a sacrifice to Caesar, in many places when you went there, you actually got a certificate that says you've done your religious duty to Caesar, and it was sealed. And so you had that sealed certificate. And in some places, you could not go into the market and purchase goods without showing your sealed certificate that I sacrificed to Caesar. So if you did not have that mark, if you did not have that seal, it was tough to find even enough food for your family. And some believe that that is what's being referenced here. All I'll say about that 666 is it's generally recognize that the number 7 is the number of perfection. So if you've got 3 sixes, you're always a little bit short of perfection. You're always not quite there. And the evil trinity apes the holy trinity of completion, 777. It always fails. Let me ask the band to come up for our final song here. Let me just finish with this. The danger of the combining of the political, military power and the religious. My own understanding of this is that we need to beware of religious voices who would try to promote the myth that any country, including our own, is God's favorite city on a hill. When Jesus says you are a city on a hill, was he talking about the United States? Was he talking about any country in the world? No, he was talking about the church. The church and Jesus. He wasn't holding up any particular form of government. And I think our government's probably one of the best kinds around, but it's certainly very imperfect. But that is not the city on the hill. When the pastor of the Plymouth Colony proclaimed that this new land was going to become the city on the hill, he was mistaken. As they eradicated the Native Americans, that wasn't the way the city on the hill is going to work. That's not God's city on the hill destroying the people who live there, right? And on and on and on. When the great religious leaders in New England were proclaiming God's freedom while they owned slaves, you need to beware of talking about how great things have always were in the old days. And our claim to be a Christian nation, it never really was. Our hope is not in a nation. Our hope is in our Lord. Let me finish. One of my friends, Caleb Maskell, was here this week for our conference on Better Together. And I didn't know, Caleb actually moved here, emigrated to the United States as a boy. He was born in England. He said, two things shocked me when I came to America. He was a part of a religious minority in England. He didn't know anybody who was a follower of Jesus were in the town he lived. It was like, oh, we're going to America where everybody's Christian, you know? And there's churches everywhere. And so he was sadly mistaken, as you can know. So, but I came in, like he was like the fourth grade. He comes into his first class in fourth grade. Nobody gives him any heads up. He's sitting there, and all of a sudden, the teacher walks in, and everybody in the class stands up. And they put their hands over their hearts. And they start to say, I pledge allegiance to the United States of America and the government which it stands for, one nation under God. Caleb says, what are they doing? They're pledging themselves to a country and a nation rather than their sole devotion being to God. He says, I got in trouble with the teacher because I didn't participate that day. But I didn't understand a country where you mixed your civil duty and your religious duty. Then my parents decided to go to the local church. He said, we went to the local church, and we walked in the first Sunday, and there's two flags up on the platform. There's one that I've never seen before. It's called the Christian flag. And on the same platform is the American flag. He said, well, I'm not an American. And many of the people here, well, I'm not American. What am I supposed to be here? Or is this church only for those who are citizens, non-immigrants? We're emerging the two. I just think that's dangerous talk. I know I'm in trouble with some of you already, I can tell. I'll bring it down to my own personal experience. I grew up in the American secular West as a part of a religious minority there. And I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship to attend Yale. So I moved to the East Coast and found myself rubbing shoulders with the sons and daughters of the wealthy and the powerful and the elite, and some of them today of my classmates are governors and senators and Supreme Court justices. The very privileged elite of America. And I did not come from there. I felt like I was looking at everything from the downside, looking up. My first week in my dormitory, I opened the door of the dormitory, my closet door, to hang up my clothes. And there, written on the wall there, was a phrase which I later found out is the last line of the Yale official song, the alma mater. The last line of the Yale official song takes this wedding of religion and state even one step further. And this is how every Yale person sings at graduation. The last line. For God, for country, and for Yale. And that's when I knew we were on the wrong track here. When we start making it a religious thing, and it's all wedded together for God and for country and for wherever I went to college, then I know that this is not true religion. Because I remember the hymn I sang as a child. And stand with me now as we sing it. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand.